I'll now call on Mr. Jones to introduce Dr. Waller.
This seems to me in this present audience to be a slightly unnecessary exercise, possibly. If Dr. Wally is not known around here, there's not much chance for any of us to be remembered. Possibly it would be useful to shake your usual image. It would be useful to shake your usual image of Dr. Wally before a reading of his poetry. He is a rather extraordinary person, and it's rather hard to find out who Dr. Wally is, or who the man behind that title is. And I think this is indicated to some degree by his various interests and his various writings. One never knows quite what he will be interested in next, or what he will pronounce upon with apparently expert knowledge, as far as I'm concerned, is expert as a rule, whether it's computers or calligraphy or Greek print or life in the barren lands or some of the inner secrets of poetry or art in general. He struck me a while ago as a kind of more platonic James Bond. He's always one jump ahead of everything else, machines and minds both. And something of the paradox, I think, of personality comes to my mind, at any rate, when I think of George Wally and Alfred Purdy, whom some of you probably heard here earlier in the year, together, at one and the same moment. Because offhand, they strike me as the two extreme types and personalities and their general image, at any rate, in society. And yet, I know they get along very well together. And I've spent the most fabulous evening on the shores of the Baie de Chaleur, over a fire till 5 o'clock in the morning with George Wally and myself and Al Purdy and F.R. Scott, which is a very peculiar and very interesting mixture indeed. And even remember vaguely being on the Baie de Chaleur around 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning with George Wally, like a romantic figure, I suppose, out of a novel, somewhere in the bow, while I was poling it with a long stick. I presumed not out to sea. I wasn't singing, although I wasn't quite sure what I was doing. I can't give a very adequate report, although I know we didn't get too far from shore. Happily for everybody here this evening, and Sir George Wally is still around to read some very interesting poems, which I suppose, looking at him as a rule in the lecture room, one doesn't realize he has. And considering all that he does, one doesn't think he would ever have time to write. Professor Wally.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a rather upside-down performance. I feel that you're, as I suggested to Doug, you're going to get the Beethoven after the Bartok, or the Sweelinck after the Stravinsky. But if you can put up with the possibility of some medieval sonorities after the sharp ironies of youth, I'd better let go. These are all poems that have been written one way and another in the last, well, while I've been at Queen's. and I'll just say a word or two about each of them as I start them. I think some of them have been published and may already be known, but the first one is called Night Flight, and it's about geese, which twice a year fly over Kingston and shake our house to its foundations. I know at the corner of Lower Albert Street, I don't know how they get their fix on it, but they do twice a year. And this is to do with those birds. Imagine the hen could trim those strident feathers for flying and rig such flimsy gear to pierce an instant of threatening rain with an arrow of geese. The fingers hooked to the string hold it humming fiddle taut to the ear, and the shoulder surging deflects the bow to a thought's prophecy, and the cosmic archer's crow's foot eyes dispose wild wings to tread the darkness southward. Imagine how in this solitude their beaks shout open defiance to the dark sky, where no star sets course for them, only the tidal pitiless sun commanding them beyond desire or memory towards an unforeknowable target of repose. And each a commander, astride the creaking silence, cries out to this pitiful grace of bones and ragged feathers, linked by hook and barb to a crazy Icarus venture. And each obedient peers unamazed at a highly improbable course, great circled in octopus juice on the black air, for each leader's cry strikes on their ears familiar magic. Therefore, these atlas necks are longbows strained to a planet's compulsion. These birds are archer and arrow, artists' annihilating will to discover purpose. These wing bones are structured against the gales of Tierra del Fuego, the singing feathers tough enough for that sorrowful region where the horn fractures his beak in the south ice. But they will come to rest short of that passion for no divine reason, dropping down weary some dawn by a lake where wild rice whispers to water. There's a longish poem here called Elegy. I'm not sure that it is an elegy, but it's a sort of reflection. And it's to do with a place that Doug Jones knows well and where I was at university and later lectured. A host of disasters may overtake a bird on the wing, its body stricken in the middle air by nerve rack, collision, or bullet. Of these I know nothing. Whatever the casual reporter affirms or guesses of course and trajectory. This was a wholly different matter. A spaniel's velvet jaws stopped the bird's heart. No tooth ruffled the breast feathers, but dead nevertheless. A hedge sparrow, I fancy, some unremarkable fustian bird, not of the soaring kind, his death more unremarkable than a song, with no throttled spectacular earthward plunge, no spiring pinions frozen in spread eagle, no lusterless feathers drifting like spoons down, no light impact to snap the fragile bones. Earthborn, earthbound, arrested, dead, here, the troweled earth, mother neutral, accepts whatever may be accepted, whatever may be gathered, beak, bone, claw, pin feather, eye, lacking a simple gesture of rejection. My fingers number each interrupted capillary, every excruciate nerve and filament barbed like eyes in the loin with spears of delight, needle points of terror. Who can order and preen these feathers for flying now, or arch these spindle bones to stride the morning, or glaze these eyes to stare the sun into pity? Or force this mouth crammed with silence to empty the light with its crying or people the desolate city. Honed to a cutting edge on the whetstone of frost, the pathways of air are deserted. No bird dare thread his flight here for fear his wings shiver like glass and scatter the snow with diamonds. But we are compelled to venture coming on foot by a devious, unmarked track to a place of stones, where glyptic records rehearse with adroit precision their repetitious and inexpressible sorrow. And being gathered, our eyes correctly reverted each from the other's nakedness, let us commit to darkness eyes that never suffered the first incredible shock of light, and having committed this last and newest testament, turn, this is no festival for mothers, turn to this other man, the one companion, bowed with an effort of unprofessional grief. Far down in the valley, a bird rises stiffly in the cruel stillness. A jet of affection splinters the numbness. He should have flown south a long time ago. And turning, find this other man is gone, gone underground, his tottering grief a frozen gesture of silence. So many dead, since and before and elsewhere, behind the wire, under the olive trees, at sea, and not a few in their beds. But here, to my knowledge, these two, plenty, a universe of dying. As for the rest, I do not know them. Let them be mourned in the best style. My song and sorrow are exhausted and overburdened by a child dead from her birth and a generous, voluble friend. Not far away, in ground unsanctified, a spaniel, clown bred in the bone, a circus prodigy from birth, and a hedge sparrow. And now that I've started, the list spins out a little. A boy shot through the head for a partridge, a not uncommon error. A girl unmade the hardy fashion of love, and an older maid, fearless in flood time, who ferried her new-baked bread across the river of death. All these in their due seasons. Here is some bravery. No make of mourning can bruise the bones of these who in the end must suffer the ways of repose. Worn to a habit of silence, the unrequited lover is caught in a riptide of gentleness. Another, knowing no graceful hope, drowns in a deep pool of accomplished innocence, and being made whole, goes forth to meet the naked terror of vision, the urgency of flight, the hard death of song. The black flutter of a skylark rising from the corn is a dying fall, no gauge of his ecstasy of song. Even the sparrow's motley belies his intricate song, conceals how by a mystery the voice becomes vision, how by a surgical duplicity the vision mounts to the throat and kindles a golden flame of song, how the amethyst beak, releasing the thread of breath, spills from the ruby throat the sapphires of death. Reverting from their bold venture, all come in a blaze of jeweled flame to the city of the sun. A shudder of cock crow is heard in the phoenix cry. Betrothal and betrayal are equal, crucified, hung like a broken crow in most cruel wise on the horns of the heart or spear points of eyes. The ritual silence commands us endow the feathers of suffering with power to renew the virgin's perplexity, a man's broken oath, the clown's wild sorrow, and a child's small death. I have another poem here, not a very new one, called Lazarus. Lazarus is an idea that has for a long time attracted my imagination. I don't know why, partly I think from seeing wheat in Egypt growing. But this poem started from seeing that sculpture that Jacob Epstein made called Lazarus, which you may have seen, a tall, more than life-sized figure standing with his head arched back and still bound in the grave bands, and having apparently just walked out of the grave. A simple command cuts his death to the bone. A stiff shadow, bound, moves out of the cave, blurred in drifting clouds of recognition. Dappled with hot shadow of olive leaves, gnarled with the ancient anguish of the vine, he stood stone still, carved out of the indrawn breath of morning, shriven, his neck arched back like a frozen wave. Only the women move, Mary and Martha rocking to and fro like bladder rack in an indolent undertow. Come home from the dead, Lazarus. So the women had keened away the three nights, never dreaming their salt and hopeless grief could turn their prayer to bitter affirmation. Over the vibrant silver of the olive trees, across the vine plants and shadow, the day had curled in an arch of lapis lazuli, crisp with menace and the dawning voices. The plumed sunlight coils its force and strikes a hammer blow full in the creased eyelids, on eyeballs wrinkled by the grave bands, bruised by the brass pennies. Miraculous, the light breaks open his eyes as though his skull had split on some relentless reef of lamentation. His head strains back, arching his neck to the impact. The hush of harvest on the taut skins of his ears, the memorable feel of his own body bound still, the animal moanings of the women, insistent as the fricture of cicadas. Out of this undertow, he claws his way to a bitter beach of consciousness. His eyes, unshrouded now, are windows looking inward and outward. No eye dare meet them. Even the women edge their shame away, disavowing their knowledge and their prayer. A shriveled heart may know the royal reprieve of greenness. By what imperial purpose, infinitely gentle, requires this hard penance, fathering an old crime on new innocence? The stiff spasms of his waking overset the calculus of grief and the cold, merciful mechanism of forgetting. His body's musk and myrrh, its tropical landfall, languid repose transfixed by arrows of regret. Stricken by the two-edged sword of paradise, his neck arched back, he raises stone eyes to the blaze of a bittered vision, pity granting life, withholding heaven. Nevertheless, the fluttering hands of embalming sorrow quicken like flowers inward, enfold and cherish a man-child it may be, or the seeds of a woman's grief, or some more numbing, some more precious mystery, nourished of suffering, perhaps an alabaster box of spikenard, for the sword was made flesh and dwells among us. This is a poem called A Fair of Honor, Clevedon. There's a place in an estate called Clevedon that stands just above a turn of the Thames, near the place where The Wind in the Willows was written about. It's not an old house, it's a rather ugly one, because the earlier ones were burned down, but the old gardens are still there. And in one of them, in a rather small place, surrounded with hedges, there grows in the grass, in a different kind of grass, the image of crossed swords and a date to mark the occasion of a fatal duel on that spot. That's what the poem is about. The date of the year, grafted in the turf with crossed swords, eloquent between the formal hedges, calls back across three centuries to this pastoral place above the sweet river, a carnal liturgy mortal in the dawn. The principals, forthright in disaster and foreshortened to stone, gaze each other pale in the truculent light under the bright eyes of the hooded girl child. She at least is present, golden, withdrawn a little to the company of stalking shadows, flattered to tears by the lion pride, enchanted by the horror dawning over the reticent formalities of the hedges. For love's sake, a virtuoso thrust asserts, crabbed as a syllogism, the scrupulous logic of honor. The casual enemy clenches his plea in a gasp of silence and gives no more evidence before the chief witness. The agile figures, sealed in the long stride of their companion shadows, are startled to stone. I see the drops of blood, humbled by the girl's gaze, blessing the grass. Can seed and rain mingle aloud and flower for pity at her frock's hem, or the eloquent blood spring into bird song, crying to plead stay of execution in strictest confidence of the formal hedges? The shadows are long as snails, the dew astonishes the spiders, the light shivers and falters, the thin pulse ebbs into silence. And she and the man, braggart in their opening of the unstaunched vein, complacent as vultures, sardonic as astronauts, cut the day of the year for joy with crossed swords in the blessed and dishonored earth, laughing to think how it turns its face to the sky for good, to celebrate a brave encounter here on the grass where the blood dropped down between the formal hedges, reticent these 3 centuries. There's a poem here that I call Dionysiac, and it's a poem to do with a friend of mine named Ted Pope, who is a very talented radio and television producer, a notable skier, a good rock climber, and was finally killed motor racing. This poem is connected with him, and it's called Dionysiac. Aquavit and beer to chase it on the patio, narrow between broken walls, and a black bird from Java in a Steinberg cage whistling in the sun. After the aquavit, a wedding relic, scotch with beer to chase it, and after the scotch, vodka. Meanwhile, Antonio Vivaldi ran his seasons, hi-fi all 4 of them, fiddling flame to the sun's smoldering quiet. Then the flamenco. Whereupon uprose Bernardino and shuffled a slow dance, seagull-eyed and penguin-footed, up and along the path in a reverie of castanets, self enwrapped, self in the sun enchanted. More eloquent even, the stillness of the silent girl whose blue unseasonable eyes and quiet hands incarnadined the air with their tendril passion. The dreaming dance of her stillness shapes in its fingers her heart to a helix of flame. Her eyes are lapis lazuli in a crystal skull. The music will never end. Her hands, as still as birds, renounce all motion, enclosed in the flame of her silence, while the sun stands still and the bird pours down its indolent song, unregarding. Here, by the brooks of desire and in the mountains, the sacrificial torches run indecorous through groves of sleep, hounding the dainty antelopes, soft to the touch, till they lie dismembered and their eyes filmed with darkness. Now, while the sun is high, while the music revolves as unregarding and blank as that bird's bright eye, the patio is desolate and the house empty. If there is life still, it does not move and there is no sign of it. The garrulous silence of an abdicated sorrow falls whimpering from dark to dark through the aching spaces of the mind, and the frenzy of this torrential sacrament is gathered into a quiet cage ingeniously constructed of blazing music, bird song, and a grave dance in a narrow place between broken walls. Doug Jones mentioned an occasion when certain poets gathered at a house named for a man best known for the Stanley Cup. Not all the poets present were major poets, and on one occasion I wrote these frivolous verses entitled, "A Minor Poet is Visited by the Muse." Abroad, early among daisies, his ear caught the surely some revelation murmur of prospective polysyllables. Happily, his clipboard was at hand, Whereon, his eyes lifted in reverence toward the sea, he set down this. Safely delivered of his song, he tethered his Pegasus to the ambrosial coffee bar of the dawn and broke his fast in thanksgiving, his eyes glazed still by the rush of spent angels to the head. I have two other poems here, and I'm not quite sure what order to read them in, but I think I'll read the more frivolous of the two first. Not that the frivolous one is unserious. It's called Pig. My household has a pig, although otherwise well provided with father and mother, a dog, two cats, and three children. The parrot died years ago. He is called Pig, simply, and fits his name well. Being made of pigskin, but his shape improvised, not stuffed, he would be too horrible stuffed. His ears are like a sow's ears, large, pointed, and pendulous, or like the melted blades of Swahili spears. He stands patiently under the piano, attentive to receive some expected command, and ready to obey with cheerful alacrity, like any able seaman. His eyes are square buttons, neatly folded, also in pigskin, not very securely attached, but perceptive, I'm sure. I think he is not a sow because he has never farrowed, and because he is gentle with small people and not possessive of the cats. I brought him under my arm from London by air in gay defiance of all airline and government regulations. Not strictly accurate, but that's how I like to think it was. I think he enjoyed the flight as much as I did, even though he was leaving his own country. He was designed to be used as a footstool or to be sat upon, and is therefore worthy of respect. From behind, he looks as confident as an alderman certain of his constituency. From long acquaintance now of his patient and eager aspect as he stands on guard under the piano or occasionally ventures into the open at Christmas time, or driven there by sweeping and cleaning, I declare that he is a noble pig, an ornament to any household, and worthy of affectionate esteem. My last poem is simply called Calligrapher. And this arises from a number of things, but partly it's to do with George Johnston, that poet in Ottawa, because we both write to each other in a rather careful style of penmanship, though the style isn't very much alike. And on one occasion he wrote and said to me, "It's ridiculous. You and I remind me of the two Chinese sages who are to be seen in a picture in gorgeous robes in a mountain setting, presenting each other with excellent examples of their own work." But there are certain references to Chinese calligraphy and the customs of Chinese calligraphy in this poem. In a quiet reverie, my left hand, in a quiet reverie, tracing a mortar circle on glass, my left hand grinds the black ink, while my right hand rests, fallen into a leopard's grace of waiting, composing itself for the shaping of an ideal form, glimpsed with a Tantalus delight in the twilight of the mind's search and the heart's recognition, a shape fluid as water, strict as a crisp enunciation, uttered against all hazard out of the strong tradition of Sing Shu. The left hand dreams in its motion, the right hand rests in its stillness, the mind, composed and quiet with the turning motion and the motionless resting, meditates examples of excellence and dwells, though it shouldn't, on the hope that my old companion will extend his wry approval. He who in gorgeous robes, did I dream this, in a mountain setting, are serving men discreetly at a distance and the air still, once presented to me in deference some writing of his own and asked me for some of mine. Will my mind today grow quiet enough and strong enough in its concentrated ease to impel from the shoulder with swashbuckling force, in one lyrical sweep, the act of insolent grace, body and mind, that moves a mountain and makes a poem of these characters, springing like a shout from heart, eye, and hand, and the secret places that love springs from, and gathered into a great impetuous outburst of drunken largeness and biblical severity? And what, resting and revolving, shall I compose or frame in the mind's eye or out of the heart's crevices? Some well-turned and memorable compliment, an exercise in virtuosity, a royal turn of phrase, perhaps, touching beauty or the turning of the seasons, or the numb and inarticulate grief of time and the ancient hauntings of regret, or absence in some desolate place, or the tongue silenced by the dignity of the heart? Or shall I write of the terrible stone violence done to Hui Tsong, though his writing, slender gold, bears witness yet to the meticulous eloquence of his measured movement and speech, that tall imperial figure, slender as his brush strokes, a young man, learned and skillful? For time has also laid rough hands on Akhenaten and his beautiful queen, consigning the city of the sun to the lizard, the painted rushes and incised scarabs, and the silent mockery of stone hawks. But there must be a moment when my right hand, fully rested, must venture forth, sooner or later, time or no time. There must be, sooner or later, a moment when it has composed itself into imperial or bombastic certitude, and can say something momentous, something old, as wounding as an unbroken promise, say, 10 characters, wind, rain, home, a foreign place, the thought of home is fire, a friend, a lover, wine is fire, the heart. Should I say this, declaring thereby that we grow old in the wind and rain, that home is a place we always leave, that we suffer alone, always, and come upon death alone, and tread down sorrow as best we can, so that the heart may flower and all desire in the end be chastened? No wonder the right hand rests like an idle leopard, and my old writing friend is quizzical. No wonder my left hand dreams and delays in its long circular reverie, as though the ink were stone and the water a black ice that refuses to flow. When the spirit of me Phi strides silently across the still landscape of my mind, pot-bellied yet sure-footed as an athlete under the towering weight of that high dome of his brow, his shirt flying open, throat to navel, enclosed in the splendor of his thought, I know that the whiskers on the nose of a short-legged pony, or the texture of rabbit fur or hawk feathers at a saddle bow, are imperishably true. That here, if nowhere else, there is a possible matching of the hand's perfection to the cunning duplicity of the eye.
I'm sure that I express the feeling of the audience when I say that we have been privileged this evening to hear a poetry that is both tough and compassionate, a poetry of such exactly delineated feeling, of such purity and precision, that one would expect from poets writing on the Canadian landscape. Thank you.